At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
This is the Yahoo Sports NBA podcast, hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews,
let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news,
to insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the road,
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
All right, joining me this week on the podcast, you've heard her here before. You can see her on the Yes Network doing the broadcast for the Nets games. You can also check her out on FS1, among many other places. She is Sarah Kustok. She joins me here in studio. What's up, Sarah?
Mannix, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
I just spent earlier in the day talking to your boy Grady on the radio, so I get the full Nets experience.
Grady's one of my favorite human beings around. And you give him a hard time, I get a little protective of Grady.
Well, I mean, as a former sideline reporter, you know, you get a kind of a read on the skill set of people. I maintain that Grady is the 31st ranked sideline reporter in the NBA.
Who are you including that you're putting him 31st?
No, 30. 30 is no sideline reporter / fan for a day.
So
he fits right in there. And his former friend in Indiana, Brooke Olsendam, is 29. So it's Brooke, no sideline reporter, and Grady.
So I don't trust your judgment at all, is what I'm going to go with. Those are two of my favorite people. Well, are we really going to start this with ranking sideline reporters?
Well, I'm only doing this now because, as you know,
you sideline report?
Well, this
for a
is why
bit?
This is why I'm bringing it up, because Abby Chin is going on maternity leave in a month or two, and I will be stepping back in to that role.
Get out of here!
Yes, so
I can't wait to critique, to tweet, to harass.
I mean, you
to
can
make fun of.
You can go right ahead, but I will, as I'll point out on Twitter at the time.
So are you going to be 32nd then?
No, I'm number one. Like when I get back in the game, I'm the best. Like there's no comparing me to anybody else. I rocket to the top of the sideline reporter power rankings.
I'm speechless. I don't even know where to go with this. I'm just glad I have Lou.
It's going to be all out warfare when I get back doing the sideline stuff amongst myself and other sideline reporters. But
I can't wait to see you, Mannix. Can't wait to see you on the sideline, and I'm going to start throwing things at you.
Well, that'll be
me and Ian Eagle.
Yes, I look forward to it. I like Ian Eagle. He's the top of the, you know.
Oh, no one compares.
Yes.
No one compares.
Although I don't do broadcast rank. I only do sideline reporter power rankings, and I've told you what the bottom is and where I stand at the top. That's just kind of how it is now. But we can discuss that at a later date. Let's talk about what's going on in the NBA right now. Saturday, this past weekend, we had our first in-game fight of the season, Sarah, featuring the Lakers and the Rockets. Longtime rivals Chris Paul, Rajon Rondo exchanged punches, all sparked by Rondo seemingly spitting in Chris Paul's face. Brandon Ingram got involved, and we had ourselves kind of a mini melee. Four-game suspension for Ingram, 3 games for Rondo, 2 for Paul. It's dubbed Spitgate now by me here. So your reaction to the Rondo...
Is it wrong that I loved it?
Spitgate?
That I loved every second of it?
No, I mean...
That I thought it was amazing, and okay. I was just sitting there and thought, the NBA is back, and this is beautiful, and I love that there's this amount of intensity this early in the regular season.
All right, give me then your reaction to the dust up.
I was surprised that the suspensions were not longer. I thought that there may have been more games for Arondo, for Chris Paul. So that was my initial reaction on the suspensions, given the fact that there was connection and actual swing. With the spitting, I don't know. Like, can you determine? I don't know. How do you get out in an investigation of whether someone was actually intending to spit, didn't spit? I know Rondo came back with some of those comments detailing that how he would have turned and looked and standing and his posture, and he would have been ready for someone to swing if he was intentionally spit. I don't know. I can't determine whether or not Rajon Rondo was actually trying to spit, but when you look at the video evidence, there is spit coming out of his mouth towards Chris Paul. But we know the history of those two. I mean, I think it's fun. I think it's interesting. I think it's the competitive nature that we have in this league. I think that happens when, you know, now guys are on different teams and are trying to just compete. And so I thought it was cool. And I have no issues with it. And, you know, I think it's far from us to really determine what the intentions were. But I liked it.
It all had a very Seinfeldian feel to it with, you know, Twitter analysis kind of looking for a second spitter. I saw some people tweeting out like saliva could have come from Carmelo Anthony's mouth at first. This is before the, you know, the Zapruder film study.
I didn't see all that. We had the NBA Phantom Cam footage. I mean, you could see it. I know the mouth guard and the mouthpiece aspect played a role in it, but I feel like I've worn mouth guards a lot or mouthpieces. Like, you could figure out a way to spit still with a mouthpiece in.
Well, this is what I was kind of waiting for. I was waiting for, like, you know, the
I've
NBA...
never spit on someone. That's not my natural answer. I may have swung at someone before. I'm not a spitter, though. That wouldn't be my natural. No, maybe I haven't swung.
Wait, let's talk about that. Who have you swung at?
No,
let's get into that.
No, I don't think I swung. In open gym, back in the day, man, things get a little heated.
Okay,
but that's right. That's why you enjoy it. And I think for all the times we talk about the NBA, no one's really going to go at each other. It's all fake fights when guys are. It was nice to see two guys actually go at one another.
I was waiting for the ESPN NBA crew, like Chauncey and Paul Pierce, to put mouth guards in and attempt to spit. I felt like we were like one day away.
We were maybe one day away from that.
From that happening, but I'll tell you, loved is too strong. But Rondo can't, you know. Came out swinging literally and proverbially after the fact.
Did that surprise you with what he said after the fact about Chris Paul as a teammate?
Oh, no. I mean, I go back, you know, you said this is a long simmering feud or something of that ilk, and it is. I mean, I remember...
I don't think I said simmering, but I liked your add-in. Right. I wish I said long simmering.
It's a long-standing, whatever it is. But this has been going on for a while. And I remember when Rondo was a Celtic, and I remember writing this back in the day, you know, Kendrick Perkins said to me just out of nowhere, I was sitting there talking to Kendrick Perkins about something that happened in the game, and I think they were scheduled to play New Orleans, you know, the following week, and I asked about Chris Paul, and Kendrick Perkins came out and said, you know, Rondo, he thinks that Chris Paul is only good because he has the ball in his hands all the time. So these two guys, you know, there's been, I'm sure, a basketball feud between them, but it has ultimately graduated to a personal one. I thought that was just vintage Rondo off the court to go out there and say, you know what, Chris Paul's a crappy teammate. And now you've got everybody kind of weighing in. You got Glenn Davis agreeing with him. You had some other reporters. I know Chris Broussard went on Fox and said he checked in with Clippers people who said that Rondo was right, and obviously that ended poorly for Chris Paul in L.A. This all of a sudden has gone from being Rondo versus Chris Paul to, as we speak here on Wednesday, a referendum on Chris Paul as a teammate. So Rondo has completely changed the narrative around the story.
Yes, and I think this will be ongoing. But what I love even more, I mean, we look at the Western Conference, and I know we're going to get into different teams and talk about, you know, who's towards the top, who's going to be able to compete, who's going to get a playoff spot. Like, to me, I love this. I love that now there's a even more brewing rivalry between a team like the Lakers and the Rockets, and, you know, you start to add in different players and different people, how that all fits in, how things play out with the Houston Rockets. You bring up Carmelo Anthony, but I think there's just... To me, it goes back to there are so many storylines, and it's so much fun to continue to watch how these different guys go at one another. And I think it's harmless. I mean, it's harmless, and it's fun, and it shows the competitive nature.
Not a great look for the NBA, though, when the players involved, you know, were kind of like, oh, I thought the suspensions would be worse. Like when the players are like sitting back going,
were you surprised?
I thought that Ingram came in and just was like throwing haymakers.
Right. Like I feel like we have seen longer suspensions or the same amount of suspensions when there weren't actually connections or punches thrown where guys were really swinging or coming back. I mean, we talk about Ingram coming back into it. That's where, you know, I think we've sometimes seen, but I have no issues with it, of course. I was just surprised that there was not more games tacked on.
Yeah, usually the NBA likes to make statements.
Especially this early on in the season.
Yeah, and look, these punches, I mean, Ingram didn't necessarily connect, but Rondo connected, yep. That's for sure. Yep. It looked like Chris Paul connected when yep. he swung. I thought it would be, you know, 5-3 maybe for Rondo and Paul, then Ingram gets 7. I don't know. I mean, I thought Kiki Vandeweghe let him off a little light on that one.
But I don't mind. Again, it goes back to, I think, you know, you kind of take it for what it's worth. And now if a precedent has been set, you kind of know going forward where things stand.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely true. All right. The Lakers kind of lost in all this, have not started the season out well. 0-3 as we speak here on Wednesday. They've been in all these games to a certain point. Overtime game just the other night. But they haven't won any of them. This was kind of my fear with this team, Sarah, coming into the season, that they were so new, and as great a player as LeBron is, it's just really hard to take a new group of players, even with a superstar the level of LeBron James, and put together a winner right away, especially in a conference that's as tough as the West is, where every single night, maybe not when they play against Phoenix, but every single night, they're going to go up against a playoff team or a team that has playoff aspirations or close to it in the Western Conference. What do you think of what you've seen from the Lakers early on?
This is interesting. And you, I know we did a podcast earlier. You had predicted that you did not think the Lakers would make the playoffs, right? Do you
right.
still feel that way?
I still feel that way.
Which bodes, I mean, and you mentioned Phoenix, like tonight the Lakers play Phoenix. This is a big game. I don't think you hit the panic button this early. And to your point, I think the first three games have been so close. So a couple shots, a couple plays here or there, and we'd be having an entirely different dialogue about what this team is and what they can be. I think the major concerns, which are obvious, has been the perimeter shooting. When you go through and look at the numbers, you know, they've got a decent field goal percentage, decent effective field goal percentage, but the three-point shooting has been abysmal. You don't expect that out of necessarily this team or this personnel, but I do believe that that's something that can get better. I think LeBron James will shoot better from the three-point line. I think Kentavious Caldwell-Pope hopefully will shoot better from the three-point line. Back to your point about the young players, there's so many new pieces, but I think, I don't know, I often forget when I look at it, like Kyle Kuzma, Lonzo Ball, Josh Hart, key players are still only in their second year in the league. So not only are they trying to figure out how to play with LeBron James, to me, there's a lot of thinking happening out there for Los Angeles, which isn't a bad thing, but you could tell that guys are trying to figure out where to be on both ends of the floor. The defense has been the weakest aspect in how they get stops and how they get stops on the stretch, how they get stops on the inside, how they're going to play in lineups when they're using a Kyle Kuzma or LeBron James at the five. Who's their backup center? The numbers bode well for them with JaVale McGee actually playing on the inside, but who are they going to use in those minutes to play that backup five spot? I think there's just a lot of things to figure out. And I think Luke Walton has the big challenge ahead because there's so many different rotations he could use. And we know with the changing NBA and how everyone is playing so positionless, you could really mix and match a lot of different things. So what works, who works well with each other? I really liked the other night, I mean, obviously with Ingram and with Rondo out because of the suspension against San Antonio, despite the loss, it was great to see that. Watching Kyle Kuzma play and him just in a different level of a comfort zone to me offensively and thinking more about scoring and thinking more about what he needed to do on the offensive end, I like to see the breakout game that he showed because he is such an integral part of this team. And you can kind of go down the list, you know, Josh Hart has been tremendous, but I think they figure it out. I don't think there should be any bit of panic. But it goes back to the point of how many games can you allow yourself to continue figuring out given how tight the West will be, how competitive it will be. But I think there's places in which they're absolutely going to improve. I think defense is a big aspect. How do they try and figure out the holes in their defense? How do they figure out defending and protecting the rim defensively? And can they make outside shots? And that, to me, is going to be one of the biggest factors, because you got guys like Hart, who you could expect, like Kuzma, hitting outside shots. But Lonzo Ball, you know, he's shooting, what, 42% from three. Is he going to sustain that? Likely not. But can it? He at least shoot 35, 36% from three? So you kind of, you go down the list and see where things will start to balance out. But to me, it's more about, you know, the big challenge ahead for Luke Walton, figuring out the rotations, the combinations, and who he wants on the floor at different times of the game.
Yeah, I'm with you that their three-point shooting will get better. LeBron's going to shoot better than 16%. Kuzma's going to be better than 27%. You know, they'll be better as a team than the 28.5% they're shooting right now. But I don't know how much better they get defensively. I really don't. I mean, they're 26th right now in defensive efficiency, and some of that has to do with the pace that they play.
Do you where are you at with, because what, they're second in the league in pace? Like, where are you at? Because to me, you see so many teams playing, and especially now, and I know the pace is up and the scoring is up across the board for the league this season.
Oh yeah.
But it is tough, and I've watched this with many teams, or watched with the Brooklyn Nets. Playing at that level of a pace, it sometimes puts your defense at a liability, and I'm not sure if they settle into a pace that's not quite as breakneck as they're at right now, especially with a player like LeBron James.
Yeah, but, like, you know, I look at that roster and I say, if they play at a slower pace, who is the plus defenders out there? I mean, LeBron, what he wants to be, and those are not, that's not for 48 minutes a game, but when he wants to be, he can be a high-level defender. But is Lonzo a high-level defender? Rondo in the playoffs has shown an ability to be that, but regular season Rondo is a different animal. Ingram, I don't know. Kuzma, I don't know, especially not playing the five spot. Caldwell Pope is pretty good defensively, but I mean, they just don't have stoppers. So even if they slow the game down, I don't know that they become, you know, this top 10, top 15 type of defensive team. They have to at least be in the top half of the league, I think, to be a playoff team defensively. And I don't know if they get there. I just don't see it.
I'm not sure they have to be in the top half of the league in order to become a playoff team. And I'm with you that who are your stoppers and who are your guys that you're going to rely on. But to me, that's where you kind of try and mix and match who you have on the floor and how you try and take advantage and exploit some mismatches and, you know, what they do, how they, whether they're trying to start to change things with the, you know, versatility of some of their players on the floor with more switching. You know, and you look at a lot of teams, and in many cases, some of these wins, it's more about outscoring teams. It's more about, I mean, we've seen so much of the way the calls have changed and the refereeing has changed with freedom of movement. I mean, how much emphasis can you put on your offense than more so, and not have to worry and rely so much on defense? To me, the defense is most concerning when you're in crunch time, when you're in a tight game, when they're in the last couple minutes of the game, their inability to stop teams from just blatantly getting in the paint or getting to the rim or getting to the free throw line. And that's where, you know, I'm not sure what lineups you use. We saw the other night JaVale McGee gets in foul trouble, so then they were just absolutely stuck. So to me, you know, the concerning part is, are there any moves that they make? Is there any moves they make personnel-wise to try and find the solution in that backup center spot, or in a spot where they at least have someone that gives you a little bit of rim protection?
Yeah, that's going to be hard, especially if you don't want to give up anything significant to go get that type of asset back in return. The last question about the Lakers I have for you is that, you know, I expected, you know, being in their camp early on when the preseason started, you expected Rondo to be the starter because Lonzo was coming back from that knee injury, and Rondo was coming off that great playoff performance. Plus, a veteran, and it's very clear that LeBron trusts him and believes in him. But how long do you think that should last there? Because at some point, don't you have to commit to Lonzo Ball being your starting point guard and being the guy that you're trying to build around? I mean, Rondo's on a one-year deal, and it's a tricky situation because he's got the experience, and obviously, as I said, you know, the relationship with LeBron James is pretty strong. LeBron's had nothing but good things to say about him. But is there a risk in not playing Lonzo significant minutes, especially fourth quarter minutes, where you know, for up until this point in the, you know, first couple of games, Rondo has got those fourth quarter minutes.
I think that's more of the thing is the fourth quarter minutes. And, you know, for a player like Lonzo and the way it's kind of worked out, and starting is one thing to me. It's who are you counting on in your fourth quarter? Who are you counting on to close the game? And I don't see, like, there was times where I've seen Lonzo and Rondo. I don't mind Lonzo and Rondo on the floor together. But that's where is Lonzo going to continue to shoot the way that he's been shooting? I mean, and he's been, you look at the percentage, it looks decent, but he's also had a couple shots that he's airballed or looked way off. I mean, where does he continue to develop with his outside shot, and how does that affect when you got LeBron James on the floor, Rondo and Lonzo? I think that goes back to who Luke Walton is using with his combinations and with his different lineups. And I think at some point you've got to invest in Lonzo Ball. You got to trust him. You got to let him know that this is going to be partly his team alongside LeBron James. But I don't think, to me, there's not a rush for that. To me, there's not, you know, you got to figure that out within the first 10, 15, 20 games. I think that can be a progression. I can see that as being part of the process of how they kind of work, who they like in their starting unit, who they like in their second unit, the combination of some of these young players and who plays well together. But to me, it's less about the starting lineup, less about are you going with Rondo, are you going with Lonzo. It's more about who are you closing the game out with and what does your lineup look like. And I think a lot of that has to do with the other guys on the floor and where you're piecing in some of these other players.
You still think they'll be a playoff team?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think we're three games in. I will not bet against LeBron James of making the playoffs, being one of the top eight teams. I understand how tough the West is. I know how tight it's going to be, but without a doubt, I think they make the playoffs. Where they land and how that all kind of figures itself out, that I don't know, but without a doubt. And to me, they still do have talent, and they've got young talent, and a lot of these players are continuing to improve. And I think when you watch them, even in the first three games, you've seen some incremental progress. You've seen them get better looks. You've seen the ball movement good. They don't turn the ball over a lot. They're getting a lot of assists. They're sharing the ball well. They have forced some turns, despite the fact that defensively they're not always getting a lot of stops. They force some steals, force some turnovers. I feel like there's a lot of aspects of what they're doing that are solid enough. And, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to bet against LeBron James making the playoffs.
Will you push the panic button if they lose to Phoenix?
I will have my hand hovering over. No, I think that's a serious concern. Like that, I think you need to kind of backtrack and really reassess. But yeah, I would be more concerned. I don't think a panic button should
ever be pushed. It's that fourth game. The fourth game does it.
I would say 15, 20 games in is where if things really are haywire, then you start to get concerned. But I think they win in Phoenix tonight. I think they start to pull things together. I also think an aspect, and again, you were there at training camp. I mean, I talked to a lot of folks who are within the organization or covering the team on a daily basis. I think they all really like each other. It's a team where they seem to enjoy one another, enjoy playing for each other. I think the young guys have bought into wanting to learn and soak up everything from LeBron James. I think, you know, some of the other players who are there, I think they enjoy playing together, and I think they understand that it's not going to happen overnight. So I think that's the other aspect. When you got guys that are enjoying playing with each other and want to grow and want to get better, I think that, you know, that's something that not every team has.
I think that's true. And I think LeBron sharpened them in training camp, but, you know, all that can kind of go out the window if they're losing games in December, January. I mean, that's when, you know, when you're into those dog days, that's when things get really difficult. But we'll see what happens.
But we're only three games in.
You're right. So. That's that fourth game, though. That fourth game against those pesky Phoenix Suns.
Watch out. Let's Devin Booker goes off.
Support for the Yahoo Sports NBA podcast comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. Let's talk about buying a home. It can be one of the most important purchases that you'll ever make. But today's fluctuating interest rates can leave you with unexpected higher payments, which can turn a great experience into an anxious one. That's why Quicken Loans created their power buying process. Here's how it works. They check your income, assets, and credit to give you a verified approval. This gives you the strength of a cash buyer, making your offer more attractive to sellers. Once verified, you qualify for their exclusive Rate Shield approval. They'll lock your interest rate up for 90 days while you shop for your new home. Then, once you find the one, if rates have gone up, your rate stays the same. But if rates have gone down, you get to keep that new lower rate. Either way, you win. It's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Mannix. That's rocketmortgage.com/Mannix. Rate shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030. All right, I'll come back to the West in a minute, but the team with the best record in the NBA as of Wednesday is the Toronto Raptors. Kawhi Leonard is out there averaging 25 points per game, looking like Kawhi Leonard. Kyle Lowry, 20-plus points, shooting 57% from three. And Nick Nurse, who I thought was the great unknown, has been really good with his rotations, going 10 deep, not wed to a particular starting lineup, not going big every single time like I think Dwayne Casey fell in love with in the past. What are your impressions of Toronto's 4-0 start?
I like Toronto. I've always liked Toronto. I'm a huge fan of Dwayne Casey, and I love already what he's doing with the Pistons. And I was calling a Brooklyn Nets game out in Detroit, and just great to see some of the changes he's made and started to implement. I also was calling a Brooklyn Nets-Toronto Raptors preseason game in Montreal, and I got to chat with Nick Nurse for quite a bit. And he is impressive. He's impressive because, and I think a couple things about Toronto. One, you're starting to see Nick Nurse was the one who implemented that offense and some of the changing, more free-flowing, the, you know, read and react, the style of play that they were playing at. So I think for most of these guys, there's so much familiarity, not only with him as a head coach now in that role, but also just what he's asking of them offensively, just some of the principles that he looks at. So you see, it's not like you're getting a brand new coach with a brand new system asking you to do a ton of new things. But he was telling me he spent the summer just meeting with so many different coaches to pick their brains about what they do, how they do things, you know, in all different, you know, MLB, Joe Maddon of the Cubs and Sean McVay, LA Ram, just finding out how you can really bring the most out of guys. So I think he's looking at what's happening on the floor, but also trying to take this Toronto team to the next level, because obviously it's so many of the same players. But I think the part of Kawhi Leonard and just how, and he's been at times, I mean, I don't think he's even near the Kawhi Leonard that we're going to see out of him as he continues to get all the rust off. But to me, he's fit in seamlessly. I mean, this is such a great fit for him and for his ability to shoot the three-point shot, work his mid-range game when he needs to. Of course, Danny Green, I don't think we often talk about him that much as a part of this trade. Like, he has been absolutely tremendous. I think that Kawhi and Kyle Leonard have been playing so well off of one another. That second unit that we touted so much last season, they've gotten better. I mean, short of losing Poeltl, it's still the same group. They've got another year of experience. They're still doing some of the same things. But I think more than anything with Toronto, for, you know, as much as you could talk about them often, defensively, they are a beast. I mean, when you look at some of the lineups that they could put in the guys they have on the floor and collectively what they can do defensively, but also individual defense. I mean, so much of defense, you're talking about with the Lakers, but so much of it is about individual defenders that can get stops. They've got that. So I'm really impressed with what they've done, but I think they're a team that has got a lot of connectivity, has got a lot of chemistry, and they're just going to keep on getting better.
Yeah. You mentioned the bench, and that was something not enough people talked about coming into the season, because, you know, they don't have the names that, say, a Boston or, you know, Golden State even, or whomever might have coming off the bench, but these guys can play.
They're good. Yeah.
They're really good. They're versatile, and we talked about versatility to a degree with the Lakers and being able to switch multiple spots, but when you've got guys like OG Anunoby and Siakam when he's coming off the bench, and Delon Wright and Fred VanVleet, most of these guys can defend and can defend multiple positions, and when you can do that, you can be an elite defensive team. So, you know, Kawhi being Kawhi is not all that surprising. Nick Nurse being successful may be a little more surprising because he was a great unknown. But now that all that's settled, I don't see a real weakness in this team. Well, I don't see one spot where it's like, well, you know, they don't have the name recognition in some of these spots, but all these guys can play. And when you're Nick Nurse and you're willing to, you know, bench Valanciunas and play Serge Ibaka and not be committed to one starting lineup all season long, which I think in today's NBA is the right thing to do, you've got yourself something. Well, they're a 59-win team that's better.
And Manek, you nailed it. And that's, Nick Nurse said that coming into the preseason. That's how he's acted. And he's got his personality. I mean, a very enigmatic person, but he's easygoing. But I think to your point that he's also emphasized to these guys and allowed them to understand that his lack of buy-in on we're going to have one starting lineup or one rotation or consistency with it allows them to not think about it. So you don't have a guy like Valanciunas when things change or he's playing more, he's playing less, or he's not playing a certain time, hanging his head, or Siakam. It's normal. And these guys know that things may change on a daily basis. And, you know, it's going to be their turn. Their number is going to get called at some point. And so that goes back. I mean, it brings back the idea of when you've got a 10-man rotation, everyone knows what their role is, what they're asked to do. I'm just very impressed. And to your point, you got some guys, too, that you don't talk about a lot. But like DeLon Wright, he's made some major strides, some major jumps. Fred VanVleet, we know what he could do. And now that they've been tested some more in the playoffs, they've got some more postseason experience. I think that they're a team that is going to, I don't know, surprise a lot of people because they already have high expectations. But to me, they're as deep as it comes when you look at a lot of these top teams.
And not to look, you know, too far ahead and over sample a 4-game sample size, but, you know, I would imagine, and I know there's at least a couple that I've talked to, you know, people looking at Kawhi Leonard being like, all right, well, Kawhi is a perfect fit for this team. He's got Masai Ujiri in his ear like every day. You know, we may not see the robust, with Kyrie Irving committing to Boston, we may not see the robust 2019 free agent market, or at least not as robust as we once envisioned if it works out for Kawhi.
I think you never know. And that it goes back to someone just feeling comfortable. And if you feel comfortable with the team, with the staff, and, you know, I keep circling back with Kawhi and his desire to go to LA, as we talked about so much, you know, before leaving San Antonio. Like he grew up in LA, he went to San Diego State, and he was in San Antonio. Like that's where he spent, you know, all of his life. So sometimes when you go to a different place and you're introduced to different people, the way an organization is run, and that's nothing against the way, obviously, how he felt with the Spurs, but it's like you never know what could happen. And a player of his caliber, and when you're winning, you know, to me, all bets are off. You can't guarantee what someone's going to decide and going to want to do another, you know, 8-9 months from now.
Yeah, and I tell you what, as I kind of assess the Eastern Conference at the moment, you know, if you look at Boston and Toronto as being the top two teams out there, home court advantage is going to be huge with
yes.
those teams. Because yeah. every time Boston goes to Toronto, they get, you know, their backside kicked. I mean, it was close, you know, for a while in that, you know, game early in the season. But last year, they went to Toronto twice and lost by an average of 19 points. They just get bullied up in the Air Canada Center. So it's never really too early to start thinking about, you know, those two potentially matching up. Because the Celtics have... it's been a little rocky to start.
Are you
the
worried? Where I'm going to. I mean, that's your team, and you're around them. The marquee sideline reporter.
Absolutely.
About to be, but what? I mean, are you concerned with the way that they're looking early on?
No, because I mean, you can't expect Gordon Hayward to come out looking like Gordon Hayward. Kyrie hasn't been good, and but you know that he is. So it's. I think there's going to come a point, and probably it's going to be in the month of November where. You know, if they lost 2 games in November, it wouldn't surprise me. Like, they can go on that type of stretch. But this is, you know, the preseason stunk for the Celtics. The early part of the season's been a mixed bag. They didn't lead for a second that Orlando game on Monday. So they've got to figure some things out, especially offensively, because they just don't look like a team that's in sync, which the only reason that's a little surprising is because coming out of training camp last year with Hayward, they were extremely confident about what they could be offensively. Maybe we didn't, I don't want to say misjudge, but maybe we didn't take into account enough just how significant it would be the team that ended the season, that group with Tatum and Brown playing 30-plus minutes, Terry Rozier playing 35 as the starter. Maybe we didn't, you know, take into account enough just how big an adjustment it would be to incorporate two new stars back into the mix.
I just think anytime too, and that's why in the Celtics, I think with both the Celtics and the Raptors, you look at them and they can always rely on their defense, which is why I see yeah. them as such elite teams in the Eastern Conference. But when you look at a team like Boston, like those guys, they will figure it out, because when you have that many people with potentials to score, and you've got score natural scorers like a Kyrie Irving and like a Gordon Hayward, some of those other guys, you know, in Tatum is such a stud. But I feel like Jaylen Brown was forced into a spot, Marcus Smart forced into a spot, maybe Terry Rozier a little bit, where they were needing to score more than they naturally would. And so it's a feel-out process, because not everyone can always put up those type of numbers in every single game. So how do you still continue to play the type of offense that Brad Stevens is asking of them, or how they go? And so to me, that takes time. But I'm curious to see, you know, with them, like who you look at as is anchoring your second unit, who you look at. I mean, do you see different guys that are going to play different roles than they did last season and still be comfortable with that? And still be able to take on the responsibility that they did, but maybe not the same type of scoring load.
It's just hard to see them not figuring it out. They're just too good. And you mentioned, you know, the Lakers liking each other, the Celtic team likes each other. Yeah. They've, you know, they've got agendas to some degree. I mean, Terry Rozier, you know, eventually wants to be a starter. Marcus Morris wants to get paid next offseason. But, you know, in training camp and in the offseason, none of that really ever came up. Plus, they've got a coach who's, you know, masterful at managing, you know, egos and making sure everybody gets a little piece of that pie. I think they'll get it. I just think I think they're on a collision course with Toronto in the Eastern Conference Finals. All right, the team that is trying to be a spoiler is Philadelphia. And the story with Philadelphia early on is Markelle Fultz. On Tuesday, Fultz had what I thought was, you know, his best game of the season, 13 points, 6 rebounds, 21 minutes. Even, Sarah, made a three-pointer. How about that? He got the start at point guard in place of Ben Simmons, who's out with an injury. The Sixers' strategy has been to load Fultz up with minutes early, especially in the first half, and replace him with T.J. McConnell or J.J. Redick late in the games. What do you think of what you've seen of Fultz and of the Sixers' strategy in rebuilding him?
I don't really want to give too much of an opinion on the Sixers' strategy, because I feel like they're the ones in it. They're the ones who have been in it with him for the last 2 years. And I think however you determine is best to build up the confidence of Markel, you roll with that. So to me, it's more just observing what they're doing. And, you know, it's such a tough situation to watch, because with Fultz, you could tell his teammates love him. You could tell he's put in the work. You could tell that he's taken all the steps to put himself in position. But there are still so many times where, you know, his hesitation to shoot or his hesitation to take shots, you know, at some point, I don't know how you get a guy to just get in his mind, regardless of what the outcome or what happens, to catch and shoot. Because so often he reverts back to his dribbling or dribbling to get into his range. But I think it's good. I like that they're starting him. You know, I think J.J. Redick has been, you know, special off the bench, just as he was in the starting lineup last season for them. So he hasn't skipped a beat. I think he's certainly helped their second unit. And I'm not sure if Markel, I don't know if he thinks about that they don't have the trust in him to close out games. I don't know if he, you know, if that affects his confidence or affects how he feels when he's playing, the fact that it's T.J. McConnell who they're going to down the stretch. But I think if you're the Sixers, you've got to exhaust every option. You've got to do everything that you can to try and get the most out of Markel Fultz, because he has some special skills that you're not going to find in players. I mean, he is their number one overall pick and someone that they've obviously put so much into. So this early part of the season, I think Philadelphia, and especially with the Eastern Conference, you have some wiggle room in terms of your positioning or in terms of what you can give up. But you know, I think it's going to be interesting to see how it continues to play out, and if it maintains the way it is now, and if things kind of stay the same, do they switch courses, and what their plan is, how much time in the timeline they have to give him this opportunity if it doesn't improve, and if his outside shooting doesn't improve, or at least his hesitation to take some of those perimeter shots.
You know, look, Brett Brown is a smarter basketball mind than I, but I'll be honest, I don't get it how they're kind of utilizing him, because
what would you rather see? What would you see them do?
I'd like to see him anchor that second unit, like let him be the starting point or be the point guard and maybe the primary scorer on that second unit. I mean, part of it is I don't know if he's a great fit alongside Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons. That may be both a short-term and a long-term problem because, you know, look, I don't think he's, at least not this year, he's not going to become a great shooter. And you have Ben Simmons who has not made a three all season long. So you have basically 40% of your starting lineup that is not a threat from beyond the three-point line. If you put, you know, Fultz with that second unit, at the very least, you can maybe build his confidence that way. You can have him go up against backup point guards. You can have him take on a more prominent role with the team offensively. And then he's not playing in the fourth quarter. It's not really much of a surprise because he's not starting, you know, anyway. I'd like to see him kind of get a mixed bag of minutes in the first and the second half and rebuild his confidence that way. I mean, the season opener was weird, Sarah. He played 21 minutes in the first quarter, yep, or the first half, and then three in the second half. And I'm kind of looking around going, well, where is this guy? What is this going to be the strategy with him all season long? And I don't know. I don't know what the plan is and how to make, you know, bring him all the way back. I just don't know if this one is sustainable for an entire season.
Well, I think you got to wonder, has Brett Brown or is, you know, someone approached him and asked him, what do you feel most comfortable doing? Does it help you to start the game? Does it help you to get into a rhythm being there right out of the gates and not sitting on the bench watch? I mean, you got to wonder how much they have had dialogue with Markel Fultz in what makes him feel most comfortable. But I do think that you bring up an excellent point about him playing alongside Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid and what it does in terms of defenses being able to sag. I mean, defenses are sagging off of Fultz. Like, they're giving him. So if they're doing that with him, if they're doing that with Ben Simmons, how that affects what Joel Embiid can do in terms of working inside the paint. I mean, to me, that's a greater issue of how you even work that out with those three players, or more so you could say the two players, and just how it affects what Embiid can do on the inside, just given the fact that defenses could just pack it in and not have to worry about getting stretched out on the perimeter.
Yeah, I just don't know how long they can keep going down, you know, this track. It seems like they're committed to it at the moment. And look, Fultz played his best game against Detroit because he had the ball in his hands a lot more. When Simmons comes back, that ball is going to come out of his hands, and he's going to be asked to be more of a perimeter scorer. And you're right. Every game I've seen, you know, one live and two on TV, teams have been able to capitalize on playing off of him, grab steals by playing off of him, just change their defense entirely because two players on the floor are not able to shoot threes.
But in some ways, like, if you're the 76ers and you just want him to take shots, if you want him to continue to just catch and shoot and not think about shooting, I don't know, but psychologically, like, maybe you put him out there when he is with Ben Simmons, so the ball is not in his hands as much, and he is forced to play. The game that he is forced to play is that he is going to catch it and be open, and at some point, you got to think that he's got to recognize those are shots that he's got to start taking.
Yeah, I'm starting. It's really early in all this, and he's got a contract. He's completely untradeable at this point, but I'm already starting to wonder if Markel Fultz is going to be one of those players that, you know, becomes a really good player, but does it outside of Philadelphia, whether it's because of the pressure of being the number one pick or the fact that maybe he doesn't fit in well alongside the two guys that are cornerstone players with the 76ers. I'm starting to wonder if, you know, it's 4 or 5 years down the line before we see the best of Markel Fultz.
Well, I think everyone feels this way, but you just hope for the best
yeah,
for him and hope that he continues to eventually figure it out. Because, gosh, you remember back when he was playing in his days in college and what he looked like as compared to how he looks now. I mean, you know, it's...
And he was a 41% three-point shooter in college.
Yeah.
It's wild. Like, you know, this whole... I mean, we saw it in baseball to some degree with, you know, I don't know if it's exactly the same thing, but with the Rick Ankiels and the Mark Wohlers and guys that,
yep,
you know, mentally just didn't kind of, you know, lost it and couldn't get it all the way back. And I'm sure Fultz, there's a degree of physicality to it, but people in the organization would admit that there's a mental aspect to it and getting your kind of psyche, you know, right in all this. So hopefully he does get it back because he was a tremendous player playing at Washington for that year. All right, let's go back to the Western Conference, and I got to tell you, the biggest surprise to me, the New Orleans Pelicans. Anthony Davis, he was pegged as a preseason MVP candidate. He is playing like it right now. 30 points, 13 rebounds per game for Davis, shooting 60% from the floor, 75% from three, you know, doing stop and start dribbles, looking like a two guard out there. on the perimeter. Meanwhile, New Orleans, who I thought was going to be one of those teams that takes a step back, they are 3-0 and putting up some huge offensive numbers. So I'll ask you this. Are the Pelicans good?
Yes. I think this is for real. I mean, you're talking about what Anthony did. Chicago kid, by the way. Shout out to Chi-Town.
Yeah.
But he, to me, he's come in. We've heard him do a variety of sit-downs. He just sit down with Rachel Nichols. He, to me, has a different mentality. Whatever happened between the time where, and we can go back to last year when the Pelicans started figuring things out with him and DeMarcus Cousins playing well, Cousins goes down, and then New Orleans refound how they could play and what worked best, and then obviously their successful run in the playoffs. To me, it's a carryover of just his confidence. He's ready to try and be the best player in the league. He's out to get the MVP. I mean, he is playing at a whole different level, and I think just the assertiveness that he's shown on the offensive end, you knew that he had all the tools, you knew he had all these skills, but to your point, he looks like he's a 6'2 guard, how light he is on his feet, his hesitations, crossovers, the way he's getting himself to the rim, and then Nikola Mirotic has been an absolute stud. I mean, how quickly he can catch and release and the way in which he spaces the floor. Of course, Drew Holiday, you know, continuation by him, but they've been good defensively, or at least decent defensively as well. And so I think they're for real. I mean, I think they're a team that they started to click in the playoffs last year and figured out some things. I know they don't have all the pieces, of course, you know, Rondo not a part of that, but I think they've carried it over. And I think all of these players, no one's really exceeding the level of how you could see them playing throughout the course of the season. And Alvin Gentry, comfortable with these guys, familiar with how they're playing. I think this is real. I think they're good, and I think they're going to continue to be good.
I love Mirotić and Anthony Davis together.
Yep. Like,
really, since Mirotić came over in that deal, they have been phenomenal. And, you know, everybody got to see it in the playoffs. There's just something about the chemistry between those two guys. And, you know, Mirotić shooting like 48% from three early on. I mean, they're just weapons from the outside. They are, you know, a modern-day NBA offense because of how they can space the floor at every single position. My question, and it was my question coming in, and it remains my question now, can that backcourt reinforce the front court? And right now, early in the season, Elfrid Payton is just balling out. He is playing like 33 minutes a game.
Wait, can we have a real talk here?
Yes.
How much do you think the haircut?
I've talked to people that know him.
Changed, and I know that sounds like a joke. I have a lot of hair, Mannix. If I ever had like bangs flopping in my hair, I don't think I would make nearly as many shots if I pulled it back.
I think this is
a real thing. Speaking of Ian Eagle, Ian Eagle would attest to this because he would talk about it every time we would look at a jump shot. And he would say, I think his hair is blocking his view. I kind of think it might have changed some things.
His hair, you know, his hair was hitting the ball.
Yes.
When he went up with that shot. So it made contact with it. So it quite literally changed his shot. And now it's gone, so maybe that's it. But he's the biggest question because last year he made 20% of his threes. Right now he's making 50% of his threes. You know, he's only shooting about 1.5-2 per game, but that's a huge number. As a team, the Pelicans are making 40% of their threes. If that keeps up, the Pelicans are a threat not just to make the playoffs, but to be second, third, fourth seed in the Western Conference. I just don't know if their perimeter shooters are going to be able to do that for an entire season. Payton has slipped into that Rajon Rondo role and playing in a way, through three games anyway, that I have never seen him play in his career. Now, maybe this is the Elfrid Payton coming of age season. Maybe he finally gets it after stops in Orlando and Phoenix, really given up on by two teams. Maybe that's it, but he's going to have to show me more before I fully buy it to the Pelicans because they don't have great depth at those guard spots. You've got Ian Clark there. You know, Frank Jackson is there. They got a couple other guys. You don't have great depth at those at guards position. And if those guys struggle, teams will really be able to key on Davis, Mirotić, even Julius Randle coming off the bench and shut them down. So that's what I'm still wary of. They're where they are right now because Elfrid Payton is just playing great basketball.
I agree. And will he shoot 50% from three? No. Will he shoot 40%? No. But I think he can be better from the three-point line than he's been in the past. I think also him surround. I mean, look at the pieces that he's surrounded by, because he's got some blow-by quickness. Like, he can get himself to the basket. He's surrounded by players. What Mirotić does in stretching the floor. He's got a five in Anthony Davis that can also stretch the floor. You look at, you know, playing next to Jrue Holiday, I do think health is going to be a factor. I do think depth is a consideration, and that, you know, you can say that about any team. But I think that they've got the right fit with guys and guys that can play off of one another. And, you know, I forgot I didn't bring up Julius Randle. I mean, I think just having him coming off the bench and how he solidifies the front court, I do think that they've got pieces that play well together. And that's something you can't always find with every team. And I think when any time that you have a player like Anthony Davis, when you have one of the elite in the league that you can go to, that you can count on, that you could run your offense through, that I feel like balances things out with the backcourt. And you're not going to need to rely on the backcourt necessarily scoring in the same capacity that, you know, that you would for some other teams or for some other lineups. And so I think if Elfrid Payton can continue to do what he's due, at least be a threat of which defenses have to respect him and have to come out on him. And I think they're number two in assist to turnover ratio. So they're also a team that moves the ball well, that shares the ball well, but they're also taking care of it. And I think when you look at some of the factors of a lot of teams of not giving up easy baskets, not giving up easy points, and a lot of that comes from turnovers and miscues on your end, that's something that they have eliminated. So I do think given their backcourt and given their personnel with their players, that's something that can be sustained.
Yeah, and look, one thing about Payton, you know, at one point he was a prized prospect. He was a 10th overall pick. He was, you know, came out of a mid-major, so he was being kind of looked at in the same, you know, sort of through the same lens as Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum and a bunch of other guys that were mid-major lottery picks. He went to Orlando, which was a dumpster fire for most of his time there.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you don't have great coaching, if you don't have, you know, a great, I would say great coaching, but if you don't have a great structure and a great, you know, organization behind you, bad things can happen. You can get into bad habits and you can't get on the track you're supposed to be on. Maybe this is the first sign. He's 24.
I mean, and that's sometimes the things we forget with guys who seemingly have been in the league for so long, or we've seen them for so many years. It's like sometimes it takes a guy a second to hit his prime or kind of figure out exactly where he fits in or how he should be playing. And I think it bodes well for him and for they play at such a fast pace. And so how he plays and how he's able to just keep the ball moving and run the offense, I think that helps how he's playing, because that wasn't something that we saw out of the Orlando team, and you kind of forget about Phoenix and what happened out there.
Yeah. All right, taking the Pelicans out of the mix, give me your biggest early season surprise. You got the Nuggets at the top of the Western Conference. Milwaukee's play good basketball in the East. Give me a team that has really surprised you.
I'm going to do, well, the Nuggets briefly, just because I feel like all throughout the preseason and heading into the season, you talk about, we know they could score, but can they play defense? And just the way in which they've defended, and Jokic is such a stud. But I've been impressed with Denver. I like what they've done. Milwaukee, I'm excited to see, because we went through Toronto, we went through Boston, we talked about Philadelphia. Milwaukee is going to be a beast, and what Mike Budenholzer has done with their offense and how he's changed and allowed them to really buy into shooting more threes, taking more threes, the comfort level we've seen out of players like Chris Middleton, obviously Eric Bledsoe, the position that he's put Giannis Antetokounmpo in. I mean, I'm excited to see how Giannis continues to flourish. But Milwaukee is a team that I'm excited to keep watching. I mean, maybe I'm a little biased. My buddy Brook Lopez out there but he's added a different component to, I mean, I'm making jokes. Like, they, you know, their center position and John Henson has been solid, but they've had situations where they've been looking to who fills in that five spot. At times, Giannis has played there and kind of trying to sort that out. Brook Lopez stretches the floor, and he's someone who will stay out of the way. And so it just, I've gotten a chance to watch them these first couple games, and they just look very different in how they play and how Giannis is being used. And to me, I expected them to make a jump, but they've got so many of the same pieces that you weren't sure what they would do, and I think they're a team that is really going to make a run at some of those top teams in the Eastern Conference.
Somebody pointed this out on Twitter, and I agree with it, that Mike Budenholzer could be to Milwaukee what Steve Kerr was to Golden State, in the sense that, you know, Jason Kidd took them to a certain point, same way Mark Jackson did, and a different coach, I don't want to say necessarily better, but certainly a coach with a system that fits the group properly, took them to another level. And look, they've tweaked the roster with guys. I saw Giannis out in Oklahoma City a couple of weeks back, and we were talking about the number of shooters he now has around him. Instead of throwing out to a John Henson, he's throwing out to a Brook Lopez. You've got shooters just everywhere out there on the floor.
Yeah.
And when you have a guy who might be, who has the ability to become, frankly, maybe the best pick and roll player ever, because he can be both the ball handler and he can be the screener and just be a monster with on in either spot. You know, you have such a potential to be dangerous offensively. And when Mike Budenholzer was in Atlanta, he put like Al Horford at a billion pick and rolls. And Al Horford became a star under Mike Budenholzer, or a bigger star, I think, under Mike Budenholzer in Atlanta. Giannis can be the same thing, because he'll be in putting these all these positions to create mismatches. And if he can become an even slightly better three-point shooter, we talked about, you know, Elfrid Payton becoming a threat. If Giannis becomes a consistent threat for me on the three-point line, he is quite literally unguardable, because everyone's going to try to play 3 feet off him. And if you can't, he's going to go right around you every time.
I mean, he really is. And he's what, I think he's 23 now. I mean, he's one of everyone you ever talk to about him, one of the hardest workers, and he's in the gym 24/7 working on things. So I have great belief that he'll eventually, and his shot looks good. I mean, he doesn't have a janky shot. It looks good. He can improve upon it. I think it will get more consistent, and we've seen him hit some of those shots. But you talk about mismatch. I mean, he's essentially a mismatch for any player. And so his ability to handle the ball and who he's surrounded by, I mean, you couldn't be more correct about that. And I think Budenholzer has seen things, has studied things, and even early on, just continuing to initiate the offense through him and making him the fulcrum of how they run the offense, where they run the offense, putting him in different positions off the block, off the elbow, top of the key, on the way. I mean, he continues to move him around. And then they've got some just really, I'm a huge fan of Chris Middleton. I've always thought he's such a good player, and Bledsoe has been playing well. I mean, I think they're a team that has got a lot of pieces that are starting to fit together. But when you put Giannis at the middle of that, it'll be fun.
Is going to be for them defensively, because they were a bad defensive team for most of last year.
But that's where I think they could fix that. I mean, with their length and with a lot of their, I mean, because that first year Jason Kidd got there, and again, it's a lot of those same core players. I know you're missing a few pieces, but they were a very good defensive team, if I remember correctly. I felt like that was one of their stronger suits, is that they played better defense, and that kind of flipped and slipped a little bit in those following years.
They were a top five defensive team in, what was that, Jason's first season.
Yeah.
And then just things kind of went off the rails there. But if they can be a top five defensive team again, they've got more than enough offense to be good. All of a sudden, you know, the East has been, those top four teams in the East, maybe five, who knows what Detroit, what they're doing right now. If Blake averages 50, we'll see what happens there.
He went off.
Interesting. It's interesting. Sarah, always appreciate you coming in. Keep up the great work over at Yes Network, Fox Sports, everywhere. And, you know, tell your boy Grady I'm coming for him.
Oh, man. Then you'll be coming for both of us, because I always have Grady's
go
back.
Team. Oh, go team. go team. Yes.
Manix, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Sarah Kustok for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.